Bursting from the subterranean depths of Wormtown like the mighty Shai Hulud, it's 508.
A show about Worcester!
It's May the 31st, 2019. This is 508, a show about Worcester. I'm Mike Benedetti. This is Brendan Mellican.
There he is.
Hi, Brendan.
What's happening? Mike, it's very warm out today, and you're dressed like it's chilly out.
You know, Brendan, I used to always wear a coat and a tie on this show, and now at least I'm going to wear a jacket on the show,
right.
If not a tie.
You look great. I'm not judging at all. I'm a fan of the trucker jacket. It is warm.
I'm trucking. That's my lifestyle. Today on the 508 show, we have transportation news, education news, a conservative economic argument, and, of course, commodities news. In transportation news, boy, I feel like everything is just coming up heads this week, man. Everything is coming up, stuff that we talk about all the time. This week at the city council meeting, in response to the research bureau's suggestion that we should just make the bus in Worcester free, because it's already bizarrely expensive to transport someone by bus, so they're paying essentially none of it,
mm-hmm.
So why are we charging them at all?
Right.
Why are we even wasting anybody's time to try to take that 2 cents or whatever? The research bureau said, just make it free, guys.
Yes.
See what happens. Like, lack of ridership has been a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Ridership is declining in part because of service cuts, but also in part because people don't like to take the bus.
Yep.
And when the economic times get a little bit better, people do whatever they can to avoid taking the bus.
Sure.
Gary Rosen this week was like, is the WRTA obsolete? City Councilor Gary Rosen. Now, it's not obsolete. That's probably the wrong word to use. I mean,
what's the word he used, though?
I'm not going to hold.
I think Bill over at Worcester Magazine did a great job in his write-up of this, saying, like, look, this isn't even something you can claim that someone's trying to read between the lines. Like, not only did he make the claim that the WRTA is obsolete when Councilor Christian King called him out on it and tried to have his order, reconfigured from a wording perspective to not include the word obsolete, Gary fought tooth and nail to make sure that we were in fact calling it obsolete.
Yes,
but still,
I would argue,
like, this is like that old problem where, like, people like to say, well, you know, Osama bin Laden didn't really think that way of us. So, like, no, he did. He told us that. That's exactly what he said. We're using his words, and it's like Gary Rosen has gone on the record multiple times now in one meeting to say the WRTA is obsolete.
So I'm not going to dispute any of that. I'll just say that if you want to really understand Gary Rosen, if you want to understand really, you have to interpret him like the Book of Revelations, which is to say that you cannot take the literal surface meaning as the main meaning or the only meaning.
I think Gary's sucking on too many car fumes from Kelly Square, Mike.
Well, he did ask if it's obsolete, and other people were like, no. He asked
it's
for the,
not, yeah, because people are using it still. Maybe not as many as we'd like, but if as long as one person continues to use the surface, then no, it's not
then
obsolete.
Then it's worth it. Gary Rosen asked for the City Council's Committee on Public Service and Transportation to hold some public hearings to talk about whether it's possibly obsolete. And Councillor King was like, how about we not say obsolete? And as you say, Gary Rosen was like, no way, dude. I totally wouldn't say obsolete.
This is the word I've chosen.
And it has been, in fact, voted to be referred to the Public Safety and Transportation Committee. I'll say in favor of the current system, like, even though we're always talking about, you know, networked buses, like, mm-hmm. some sort of combination of Uber and shuttle vans as being our dream, like, for many routes, A big bus is the best way to do it.
Sure.
Because the main cost of a vehicle is the driver of the vehicle.
Right.
So even though the van is a lot smaller and so probably gets better gas mileage and is easier to maintain, you still got a lot more drivers per person, which means that the price is per person goes way up.
Yeah.
That said, I don't think anybody can look at saying, oh, yeah, we basically pay $5 every time somebody in Worcester takes a trip on the bus.
Right.
In addition to whatever they pay, we pay $5. Like, is that a system that makes sense?
So we've been talking about this for months, years, really. And
yeah.
I think on a very superficial level, like, I kind of agree with Gary, right? Because that's what we've been saying for a while now is the idea that
he's ripping us off.
He's totally ripping us off. He finally got around to listening to us, and he's run out of his own material. He's talking about the use of ride-sharing services, Uber, Lyft, whatever, as a meaningful component of public transportation, which I don't think anybody denies, right? I mean, that we've talked about this. That's actually part of the organizational structure of Lyft, going back to when it was just an idea in an MBA program, was a as being a long-term component of public transportation. But I don't think Gary actually knows that, right? Like, I think he's actually right by virtue of having no idea what he's talking about, because he seems to be indicating that, like, oh, maybe Worcester should start its own rideshare service. Like, no, like, we actually don't need a municipal rideshare service. It's the last thing we need. What made so much sense to me about the Research Bureau's report was not just looking at it from a perspective, like you said, nobody's really paying for the service anyways, right? Like, the contribution of the riders is not even in the...
It's not negligible, but it's quite the minority of the cost.
It's a rounding error in the mathematics, right? So, I mean, that shouldn't be what we're focused on. But what I was thinking of, you know, when I was reading that report was... think of like Leitrim's, like a bar like Leitrim's, right? Yes. Like on a Thursday night, when every Uber and Lyft in the city is getting lined up outside of Leitrim's to take everybody back to Holy Cross, right? Like, that's where a WRTA bus, a free bus, actually makes sense, yes. Right? Like, we know where the people are, we know where they're going, we can capture 40 of them right now, and all it's going to take is one guy with a mop to clean up all the vomit after we get them back to the hill. No elderly Uber drivers are accosted in the process. Nobody's CDs are thrown all around Pleasant Street.
Yes.
You know, you just have people picked up and people moved, which is the goal of public transportation, right? And that has benefits across the board, because now the folks that have individual destinations to go to at that moment in time, they're not paying surge prices on Uber and Lyft, because
they're just sharing.
There are actual Ubers and Lyfts available. The system starts to work. And I think that's the part that's being missed here, right? Of course, public transportation is not obsolete, and the WRTA isn't obsolete. It may very well be that the way we're using it right now is obsolete, and that's the thing that we should be thinking about more. What better way to do that than to remove that fare system from the equation and start looking at, like, well, where do we have the most people who need to be moved in the most efficient way possible, which is still a bus, and start doing that, right? Like, if we're always complaining about, like, well, these college students aren't leaving campus, and then you talk to the college students, they're like, yeah, we have no way to get off campus, and we don't know where to go. What a great place for the WRTA to swing into action and actually start moving people around.
Yes, and this is right. These are the kind of situations, too, where it feels like we should either be subcontracting Lyft or Uber as part of this in order to provide some of these services, or we should just be saying that as part of being allowed to operate in a city, you got to like share some data. I don't know how you set up the incentives right so they share you the right data, but that's what you'd want to see, right? You'd want to be able to, the WRTA to be able to look at the paper once right. every 6 months and say, oh, every Friday night around 2 a.m., there's 100 people trying to get from this corner to Holy Cross. Let's set up a bus route to
right.
do that. And again, for like the incentives to make sense so that Lyft doesn't try to hide that, because they want those 100 rides.
Sure.
But the last thing the city of Worcester wants is for those 100 rides to be in 100 separate cabs.
Exactly. It makes no sense.
Or for any of those rides to be people just driving themselves super drunk across the city of Worcester.
Yeah. And again, I just feel like this is one of those things that, I mean, it wasn't that long ago that we were making fun of, well, I think even Gary, but like most of the city council, because of their knee-jerk reaction to the very existence of Uber and Lyft, right?
Yes.
I mean, the bizarro protectionist attack that everyone took in favor of the cabs.
This is a good point. They're sort of going from, like, let's make Uber and Lyft illegal to let's just give everything in the city over to Uber and Lyft.
So
in about a blink of an eye.
I just want to be clear that, like, for those of us that have been paying attention to some of this stuff for more than the last 15 minutes, the irony is layered very, very thickly here, and
yes.
it's not lost upon some of us. That's great that you're joining the conversation that we've been trying to have about the 21st century for a while now, but let's not pretend that you were also the very people who were trying to dismantle all of these services when they first came about. So please don't pretend that you're now making this super pro business and meaningful Worcester of the future argument here. You just have no idea what you're talking about.
I just want to wrap this up by saying, as I said before, don't listen to what Gary Rosen says. Don't listen to what Gary Rosen says about what he says. But think about how he thinks about how he thinks about what he says about what he says, and that will tell you what's really going on.
Then it all makes sense. We'll have to have Gary on this show when he's done with his show, and then we can needle him about that in person.
I have a news item here, which is basically I don't know, kind of a positive news item in disguise, but basically a negative news item overall. Did you see this thing, the study put together by a Florida drug rehab finding that Worcester had the fifth highest percentage of homeless students among U.S. cities?
Yeah, that was actually one of the most grim things that I've read in a really long time.
Did you? Now, I assume that, for example, like everybody who read this newspaper article, including probably the person who wrote the article, you didn't look at the study directly.
No.
So I'll tell you.
Tell me about it, Mike.
Based on reading this study a couple of times,
is this nonsense data? Is that the?
Yeah, oh, okay. It is. Okay. So they're measuring homeless students per 100,000 residents. So the bad news is that we have homeless children in the city. We need to keep working hard to help them. Mm-hmm. The good news is that this specific statistic is stupid.
Okay.
I don't know if we're doing a great job with homeless students or a terrible job with homeless students. But one thing I know with complete certainty is that we do not have the fifth highest student population, homeless student population in the country.
All right. Congratulations, Worcester.
What are some things that would make this statistic, homeless students per 100,000 residents, for example, go up? What would make that statistic look worse?
I would say children without homes.
That's true. Also, better homeless services in a city, which would encourage homeless families to move there. So, for example, you might see that we had a higher level than Holden because Holden had fewer homeless services. So if you were living out of your car and you had a kid, you would be trying to park out back at someplace in Worcester and be in the Worcester or be connected to the Worcester public schools rather than the Holden public schools.
So also, it's actually like a choice issue then, like a school choice issue.
Also, maybe the school system is doing a better job it possible for a student to attend.
Yeah.
Part of it is a choice issue. Part of it is
I just want to be clear that I'm not saying that it's a choice to be homeless. I'm saying that it's a school choice issue, whereas like we oftentimes will have students come in or out of the district, say for special needs reasons, where we don't have the services to provide to that child, so you might go to the Wachusett district because they have that specific service covered, or vice versa. It sounds like that's what you're getting at. I just didn't want to make it sound like I was being trite and saying that people are choosing to be homeless children in Worcester.
And there are many times also, we'll just say this, when homelessness is a choice, it's the lesser of two evils. I would like, you know, you have a kid and the father of that child who you've been living with is super violent and terrible, and you're like, we're going to live out of the car rather than live with this son of a bitch.
Yeah.
We'll live out of the car for a couple of months and try to figure something else out. Generally, living out of a car with your kid seems like a bad idea, but you could see under those circumstances, if you didn't have anything else to fall back on.
Right.
That might be your best option you have. You have two bad options, and that's the least bad one. Most homelessness is
but
not
the
that,
number,
but
though,
it does happen.
Even if we do approach it from the perspective of, you know, Worcester is so good with services that
all homeless people want to move here.
That we are in fact encouraging people to come to Worcester for those services, which I would view as a positive. That like at least there's stability on the education front. We're not arguing with the number though. The number is still what it is.
Well, so the numbers are U.S. numbers, so they are what they are. I guess I'm arguing the meaningfulness of the number. So another thing that would change this number that would make it go up is if we were doing a better job of tracking homelessness.
Mm-hmm.
So if the city of Worcester were doing a better job of tracking local homelessness than the city of Holden, we would look like we had more homeless students per 100,000 population than Holden did, even though. And I would say that Worcester, considering the density of social services here, probably does a relatively excellent job of tracking homelessness among its population. Also, you know, the school system themselves paying enough attention to the kids to be able to know how many of our kids are homeless and how many of our kids were just like, I don't know, that kid's home life is messed up. I don't really know what's going on with that kid.
So the two things that I would throw out there, though, that I think are important in what struck me the most with this study, not just the study, but the response to the study was, one, you mentioned tracking, right? Like that's obviously, if you're going to try and do anything in terms of social services in need, knowing what you're dealing with is the most important part.
Yes.
This is totally anecdotal, but I have a child who's in the Worcester Public Schools.
Not homeless, though.
Not homeless. So let's take this week, for example. This child that I happen to have in the Worcester Public Schools has been in D.C. for a week on a school-sponsored trip to the nation's capital.
Yes.
And every day since he's been gone, I get an automated phone call from his public school telling me that he was marked absent.
Oh, man, your kid is so bad.
And he's a terrible child, right? Like, it's throwing off the curve for everybody. But when it comes to tracking students, clearly this is not the public school's strong suit, right? Like, they're not able to track the students that are not in school because of a school-sponsored trip. He's not down there with his aunt, right? Like, he's there because a teacher put him on a bus and took him there.
Yes.
The same thing happens when we get automated phone calls all the time. when he's tardy, Mark Tardy, right? Mm-hmm. It's only because the school buses were running late, right? Yeah. So one, I would just like to point out, I don't think tracking is the public school's strong suit right now. Because their system seemed to be a little bit antiquated.
Over-tracking, though, would still probably increase the number of homeless students in your school at least a
right.
little bit. Because at least somebody, at least you're getting one phone call a day to your mobile phone saying, where's your kid? We know he's absent. And you're like, okay, I got to figure a way to get this kid to school.
Even totally.
I'm living out behind the Walmart and working part-time at the Arby's.
Yes. But even when they are there, they're not there, according to the public schools. The other thing, though, yes. I think the superintendent's response to this was just bizarre.
I have one more item here on this thing.
Well, so, finish up then.
So the last thing is that you would have a higher percentage, according to this, you would have a higher percentage of homeless students if you had a younger population with more school-aged people, because that's the problem. You're not comparing this of 100, you're not saying what percentage of your students are homeless.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying what percentage of your residents are homeless students. That's what you're saying. So if you have one city that is 40% kids and one city that's 30% kids, the first city looks like it has a 10% worse rate of homeless students because it has 10% more kids in it.
But we're still doing it per capita, though, aren't we? So that should balance out in the end.
No. If 40% of your people are kids and 30% of your people are kids, you're going to have 10%. That extra 10% is going to be more homeless students.
Yeah.
But nothing in this study is balancing for this. This, of course, is basic math. Any student, I'm sure homeless students, excellent with math, could definitely do this math problem of just figuring out, how about we figure out how many students per students are homeless students rather than students per capita? Because San Jose, California, for example, has a very, very low rate of homeless students, in part because it's super expensive, so there's probably not a lot of homeless people in San Jose.
Sure.
But possibly in part because maybe San Jose just has an older population, or a population which is mostly made of people who are 20 and have no kids.
Yeah.
I mean, if you don't have a lot of kids in your city, then you don't have a lot of homeless students in your city. And so then you look great according to this. Again, this is like this weird combination. This is just the wrong number to be drawing any conclusion from.
I get you.
So this is where I look at that fourth one. We can always complain about a study and say, this study is just showing what it's tracking, and tracking is better or worse in a city, so therefore it's different. That's always a problem. You kind of can't do anything about that. But dividing the wrong numbers, dividing two numbers that make no sense with each other, and that's literally what this study is doing. I read the study twice to make sure that's what the study was doing.
So
this is what they're doing.
I guess this only highlights then my actual concern with the way this was reported, was that the superintendent's response is basically to come out and say, we're very much aware of this problem and we've been doing whatever we can, or something along those lines, for quite some time now.
I think that's the right response. You know why? I think that the newspaper reporter doesn't want to hear you say this is a bunch of nonsense.
Well, especially after the last couple months.
Right. Because in the same way, I mean, like, the newspaper reporter doesn't understand enough about the study to be able to look at the study and say, this number is, I mean,
right.
The number is not false. It's just not showing what you think it shows. And I literally saw on social media people saying, I saw this number, and, like, I wept because I was like, this is so terrible.
Right.
And, like, homeless kids is terrible. I know homeless kids. Homeless kids is terrible. Even if you didn't know homeless kids, you would feel like it was terrible that kids were homeless. And so you should weep for the lack of homeless children, but you shouldn't weep in particular because of this study more than the day before, because this study doesn't show anything about homelessness.
This study is more like what you see in listicle-style news, where, like, Worcester is in the top 10 cities to get a lobster roll in February. It doesn't actually mean anything.
So the superintendent shouldn't read this study, and if the superintendent or somebody working in her office has read this study and realized this number is kind of nonsense, they should – right, not kind of nonsense, sorry – totally nonsense and stupid. The superintendent shouldn't say, this is stupid.
Right.
Because, again, the reporter doesn't even understand the study. They're definitely not going to put your comments in context. The reporter doesn't want to hear you analyze the problems of a study, nor does the electorate. The electorate wants to hear you say, we care about the issue of homelessness in students,
right,
and we do things about it.
The thing is that I just kind of rubbed me the wrong way was the response from the administration. So it's still a relatively small number, right? I guess is the point. Like, let's take the study at its worst.
Sure.
when you're looking at homelessness in Worcester versus this subset of homelessness in Worcester that involves, in theory, more vulnerable human beings than the overall homeless population, right? Like, you would think that this would be a really great place for the city with all of its services to be starting working on that problem. And I guess the response in that context just seemed a little, we're aware, we're working on it. And it's, I don't know that that's the right approach, right? Like, this seems like to be the ideal population within the larger homeless population to actually be doing everything humanly possible, even if it's just as an experiment, to right a ship and get people back on their feet, right? Like, if we're having housing first conversations, right? Like, in my mind, those conversations should start with families that include homeless children, right? That we're aware exist because they're in the public schools and they're being tracked in some fashion.
Yes.
If we're going to have conversations about, hey, are we sure that every demographic in the city is getting access to civil service listings for employment within the city and via the city to offer stability? Like, to me, like, those conversations should start with, like, oh, are we getting these advertisements in the hands of parents who have children who are homeless, right? Like, and that's the thing that, like, I haven't seen any of that. I'm not aware of any of that, and it kind of breaks my heart that we have, even if the number's inflated, right? That, like, there's
It's not that the number's inflated. It's that this statistic is not useful for understanding the problem of homeless students.
Right.
But this number should not be useful.
It's incredibly useful in just recognizing that we have a problem in the city that involves children without homes, and that would seem to be the place to start when it comes to dealing with homelessness as a whole.
Well, I mean,
if we're going to prioritize anyone, I guess.
This number definitely says that there are. The number of homeless students in Worcester is larger than zero, which is too high.
Right.
So
sure.
That's certainly helpful. But again, like, the number you want to see really is how many of your students, percentage-wise, do you have more or fewer homeless students than the nation as a whole, Massachusetts mm-hmm. on average. If you're better than the nation as a whole or better than Massachusetts on average, then you say, great, the programs we're doing are working and let's keep doing them. And if you're worse than Massachusetts on average or the nation as average, then maybe you say, hey, actually, we probably should put a little bit more resources into this, because if Holden can do a better job than us, then we can do that good of a job. You should probably also be factoring in socioeconomics here and saying Worcester's a way poorer city than Holden. So there's a lot of people in Worcester who are way closer to a situation where they might become homeless due to resource issues than in Holden.
Yeah.
So that's really the number that I would want to see is based on how poor and how young our city is, are we doing better or worse than the national average?
Right.
And if the number is greater than zero, then we have a problem for sure.
Mm.
But if we're doing better than the national average, then we're doing effective things to deal with that problem. Better than the national average based on the situation that we're in.
I know that we're supposed to be the libertarian voice of Worcester, but I would take exception to that in the sense that, one, we're talking about kids.
Well,
an age thing, but I kind of take seriously the idea that there was a time that when we declared war on things like poverty and hunger, we actually meant it.
Yes,
and
there
was that beautiful
during
moment.
During the life of Lyndon Johnson.
Well, he didn't do that great of a job with poverty. Just Appalachia is still pretty damn poor.
He did declare war on it, though.
Yeah, he did. But you know, unlike wars on drugs or terrorism, which are usually just meant to fuel industry that are going to be active in fighting wars, not actually solving a problem. This seems, again, like the perfect opportunity where we're having conversations constantly about housing in the city of Worcester, right? I was just reading another article today about another like 10 billion units going online soon or going into construction soon down in the Canal District. Isn't that like where the city is supposed to step in and say, okay, like, this is the population that is the most vulnerable that we're going to take seriously from a housing first perspective, and hey, developer, like, people are sharpening their pitchforks and lighting their torches over here. This is where we can find where we can meet in the middle, and whatever that number is, it seems like this is the place to start, right? And that's all I'm getting at is that, like, if you're gonna take methodologies like housing first seriously, if you're gonna take homelessness seriously, let's even declare a war on homelessness, right? Like, this would be where you'd want to start. You're talking kids, and because they're a part of a public system, they're easily tracked. How long ago was it? Again, something we were a little bit judgy on, but it wasn't too long ago that we were putting people on the streets with clipboards to track homeless people,
yes,
right? Like, that
yes.
was our solution to panhandling. Was like, we're gonna tick off every box for every homeless person in the city that is panhandling, which doesn't even make any sense because it's a weird assumption to make that somebody who's standing on the side of the road, whatever. these kids, like, we actually know where they are. We know that they're actually homeless, right? Like the city should, because the school department's acknowledging in some capacity that they know they exist. Yes. And they've been tracking them. It seems like all of our efforts from a housing perspective, from a homelessness perspective, from a social services perspective, would be easily focused on that population we already know exists and, like, we have the names and last known addresses of.
I just want to say, in respect to us being the Libertarian Voice of Worcester, I want to first acknowledge the Libertarian solution to this problem. Which would work very well, which is shut down the public schools. And then we have no public school kids who are homeless. It goes down, the number drops to zero. Yep. Overnight if we just do that.
We can get rid of homes, too, and then everybody is on equal footing.
We just build the second thing, the real solution to this, because shutting down the public schools is not a practical solution. The real solution to this is universal basic income.
Obviously.
Conservative economic argument of the week is the next thing on my list. What's after that? Commodities news. So let me go do this before getting into conservative economic article of the week. Brent crude oil is $64 a barrel, down 7% on the week and 14% on the year. Hmm. Bitcoin is $8,300, up 2% on the week and 11% on the year. 2% on the week is much slower than its recent growth, but Bitcoin's still booming this summer.
Yeah.
Yeah, Brent crude oil still heading down.
My gas prices are still going up, though.
I guess there's a delay in the system. You know, we're going to have a corn famine this year.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and so that, again, like the cost of anything involving corn, which would include
ethanol,
lot of meat, and would include anything involving corn syrup, as well as like tortillas or corn on the cob or whatever, going to go through the roof, but there's going to be this delay as it works its way through the supply
chain. Well, and ethanol as well, too. I mean, there's a massive amount of ethanol in our gasoline supply. What do you have any knowledge that you can share with our listeners as to why we're having a corn famine?
It's a weather thing.
Okay.
I think that there's a certain time of the year when you're basically supposed to get your corn in the ground before such and such date in May. Hmm. And if you don't put it in the ground by then, it's like, forget it. It's not gonna ripen in time for you to do anything about it.
Can we blame this on climate change?
Yes, we can. Of course, we should blame this on climate change, just as we should blame our global refugee crisis on climate change,
and
even though we don't.
Is universal basic income a potential solution to this corn famine?
No.
Okay.
No. This is the one, maybe the only thing. Wheat famine, sure. Corn famine doesn't.
But this
work.
We were talking about something a little bit before the show that I won't get in the weeds on because it would be nonsense for our listeners and take way too long. But I mean, I did not realize that we still are the number one exporter of food in the United States. And I think that's something that we take for granted, right? That, like, you and I, our prices for candy bars and hamburgers might go up here in the United States because of a shortage of corn. But Mexico is our number two importer of U.S. Food staples, corn being one of the largest. And when you take something like tortillas out of the system, that's crazy, right? Like, you're impacting massive numbers of people. And I feel like we just kind of...
Yes,
we shrug this one off a little too easily sometimes.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. If you have an American corn famine, you have a global corn famine, presumably.
Like, we're thinking corn chips, right? And, like, well, there's enough of them in the pipeline, so we'll be fine. We're not really necessarily thinking
there's
about the millions
of
people who are actually relying upon corn as our corn as a staple crop.
Yeah. So, I don't know. Stockpile Fritos now. I don't know what you do about this. Conservative economic argument of the week. Eric Holland and Alex Tabarrok have a new little book out, Why Are the Prices So Damn High? Health, Education, and the Baumol Effect. You read Marginal Revolution sometimes. You may have seen Alex Tabarrok posting about this a lot this week. Did you read it?
Not this week.
Those?
Nope.
The Baumol Effect is easy to explain but difficult to grasp, they write, and that is, in fact, my experience of reading this book and reading this thing. Here's one of the sentences, one of the paragraphs where they explain it that might be helpful. I keep trying to think of what's the most helpful way to explain this. It's the kind of explanation where it starts off slow and then it just like goes off a cliff and you're like, wait a second, what did you say? And then even trying to apply it is way worse. But here's the explanation. Costs increase when output productivity grows only slowly, but industry inputs have rising opportunity costs. For example, the cost of education has increased because teaching productivity grows only slowly, and the education industry uses skilled labor, which is increasingly valuable elsewhere in the economy, which means that teachers are going to get more expensive just because skilled labor, just like I could be a teacher or I could do some other kind of skilled job if I'm going to go to college for 6 years, you got to raise my salary as a teacher to something.
Sure.
Note that the economy needs both of these effects to operate. The productivity of bus driving has not increased much over time, but bus driving uses an input, unskilled labor, with a relatively declining opportunity cost. Computer chip design uses skilled labor, but costs have fallen because productivity has risen rapidly. So if you got a sector of the economy where productivity is rising slowly and where you use skilled labor, you're going to see the cost of those things in that part of the economy go up over time. And so, like, there's the famous graph,
there which it is.
You see on the internet sometimes, which is looking at, this is just looking at January 1998 to December 2018. They're looking at like 1950 versus today.
Mm-hmm.
So they find that, and they analyze 139 industries, and they're basically looking at like any other explanation for like why has the cost of education gone up since 1950
sure.
by threefold? No, sixfold. Higher and lower education are six times more expensive than 1950. Legal services, accounting services, and healthcare are three times as expensive in 1960. Home appliances are one-seventh as expensive. Cars are half as expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Car maintenance is twice as expensive.
Mm-hmm.
They look at 139 industries. They basically go through every possible alternate explanation for why, like, in certain things have gotten more expensive. So, like, people say, oh, healthcare prices have gone up because malpractice. And malpractice costs...
That never really made any sense to me.
Well, and they're like, whatever affected that is pretty small. And
did they talk at all about federal subsidies?
They look at everything. They look at regulation. Like, basically, they're just saying, like, how... Like, do we see a lot of discontinuities? Do we see mm-hmm. a lot of volatility in this number, which would say, like, oh, people put regulations in place in 1970 and lift them in 1980, and so therefore do we see the price jack up and down? Most industries, the answer is no.
Right.
That it's not and they compare this to, like, things like all-factor productivity or productivity of other product rather than service-based parts of the economy. I'm not going to pretend that I understand the analysis that they do. I'll say that
right.
I read this paper, and, like, the kinds of questions that come to the top of my mind, like, are you doing this per 100,000 people or 100,000 students? They deal with all of those.
Yeah,
or
yeah.
Questions like, is college more expensive because, like, they have nicer gyms? No.
Mm-hmm.
That's not why college is three times as expensive.
See, the one thing
six times as expensive.
The reason I was asking about subsidies, because that's always been the one sticking point for me that I'm sure they did cover. I'll have to
dig into
this. Industry
concentration, not an important factor.
But when you, it seems like for healthcare and education, the one common factor with both of those that is out of the hands of the consumer, right, is that we have a federal system that sets price points, but, like,
yes.
basically is willing to lift those price points, right? But then you have a private sector middleman that's in charge of capturing those
yes.
dollars as they come through. And it seems like that's, again, I'm obviously totally ignorant of that. That seems like one of the driving factors with costs going up,
yes.
that you've got consumer demand growing for two industries where the federal government is basically willing to say, well, whether it be via credit or by setting a baseline for Medicare, these are what the prices we're going to allow. And then this massive bureaucracy that stands between this massive corporate structure that stands between the consumer and that end product
right.
is allowed to manage that cash flow. And it seems like that's something that people don't like to talk about too much, that, like, it's at least potential that maybe our costs of college are in fact attached to the fact that, you know, the federal government has never said, okay, Harvard, we're not actually going to back student loans for your ridiculous tuition.
They look at that issue, and they also look at, is this because of some sort of weird thing involving, like in healthcare, generally the decoupling of the individual consumer usually
yeah.
not paying for their health care. And both of those, they would say, this is a factor, but this is not the factor.
It's not the factor.
It's not, I mean, health care is not six times as expensive because it's six times better, because it's not. And it's not six or three times as expensive because it's three times better, and it's not. And it's not three times as expensive because you tripled the amount of overhead and administrative work and inefficiency because of subsidies. That it's mostly three times as expensive because productivity in healthcare has not gone up mm-hmm. very much since 1950, whereas so if we look at things that have dropped in price, we're talking about a lot of basically manufacturing stuff.
Right.
So that most manufacturing has dropped since then, and so the average manufacturing worker who can get a job in the United States
mm-hmm.
is making a lot more money. This person who's a skilled person who can operate machinery, operate a factory, operate
sure.
robots, work on that kind of stuff, those kind of jobs you get more productive in, and so it drives up wages in other parts of the economy also.
Mm-hmm.
They would point out that.
But I guess that's where I get.
This is not particularly a bad thing because we don't care about cost. We care about cost, but cost is not much like the goofy statistic of homeless students. We don't care about cost. We care about affordability. So if wages go up, if wages double and mm-hmm. costs go up 10%, we're like, that's great.
Right.
That's spectacular. And if that's what they see. So some people call the Baumol effect Baumol cost disease or the cost disease
mm-hmm.
because it's kind of unavoidable that the areas where there is increasing productivity growth make it so that a car gets cheaper, makes it so that healthcare gets more expensive.
Right.
Like they're saying, like, the nice thing is that frequently a rising tide lifts all boats, so that even though healthcare is more expensive, if people have more wages, they can afford more healthcare. Sometimes, in some cases too, you're going to buy more healthcare because a lot of times you'd rather double the amount of healthcare that you have than double the amount of cars that you have.
Sure.
Or the amount of houses that you have. Or you would rather double the quality of education or the amount of teacher hours your student is exposed to rather than buying yourself an extra car or buying yourself two refrigerators.
But so I guess that's, again, where I get hung up, and I'm not obviously not intelligent enough to challenge any of this, but it's you're actually not describing healthcare. You're not talking about the costs of healthcare. And they're not talking about the cost of healthcare. You're talking about the cost of health insurance, because the cost of healthcare is set by the cost of insurance by the price points that are allowed by health insurance, right? So when the federal government comes out and says this is what Medicare is going to pay for a prescription drug, that's now your baseline cost for that healthcare service. But that's the health insurance setting that price. It's not a free market system in the sense that I think a lot of people would like to believe that
it's
it is.
It's very much not. It's very much
in
not.
The same way that, you know, again, an Ivy League school or a community college, for that matter, if they know that the majority of their the students who are going to attend, or a significant portion of them, are going to be receiving on the receiving end of federally backed loans, right? Then, like, whatever that federally backed loan system is willing to afford a prospective student automatically becomes the cost of tuition, right? Because that's what the market's going to bear. But the market isn't based on what somebody can actually pay for that service. It's based on what the folks in the middle of that system, combination of bureaucracy and a corporate structure, are willing to shell out almost in the form of a loan, right? Like, that's
yes.
the part where I think their argument is just a little bit broken, right? Like, and it's always been a sticking point to me that when we talk about healthcare in the United States, we're actually having a conversation about health insurance. Healthcare is when you're on a plane, somebody has a heart attack, and a flight attendant yells, "Is there a doctor on the plane?" Like, when that person who jumps up and springs into action, that's healthcare. Health insurance is what most of you get from your employer or from some form of government that allows you to see a healthcare practitioner at little to no cost of your own. The two have absolutely nothing to do with one another, right? Like, confusing the two is the most bizarre thing that we started doing, it seems, back in the 70s. And I think it's something we did intentionally because it's very beneficial to all industries involved. But they're not the same. Like, you don't go to medical school to learn how to prescribe health insurance, right? You go to medical school to learn how to treat human beings with ailments. And there really isn't a cost associated with that, right? There's just not, until a middle person steps in the form of a health insurer and says, this is what we're willing to pay for the treatment that this provider is capable of providing for you.
Yes. Well, as I said, too.
That's why, like, I think the conservative argument is always broken when it comes to healthcare and education.
Well,
like,
I also will not claim to be intelligent enough to understand this, or at least with the amount of work that I've done on this. Like, I've spent a few hours reading this and thinking about this. And like I said, like, once I start thinking about more than about one step down
yeah.
the path of logic, I'm just like, crap, this is getting really complicated. What's the cause and what's the effect? Like I said, like,
well, you know what? Let me take a step back.
There's a PDF of this on the website. I would encourage you. I'll listen to the It Can Happen Here podcast if you read the
PDF
about healthcare.
So let me just approach it from the other side then, where you see decreasing costs, right? So, like
yes.
you said, automobiles.
Yes.
Well, so there's a big difference there, right? There was, when it came to the automobile industry, the lobby that was involved with the automobile industry typically had two factors to it. One was the safety side of things, right? Like, where you had the industry lobbying the government to not roll out massive safety programs that were going to cut into costs for the auto industry. But that's over here. The other big aspect of the lobbying side of things was on the union employee side, right? To like, it was more protecting the human beings involved through things like automation. That side of the industry has been mostly decimated, right? So that's where I think you're talking, when you're talking productivity going through the roof, a lot of that ties in directly with automation.
Yeah.
There is no lobby from the car industry that shows up to Congress on a quarterly basis saying, we need Congress to mandate that cars cost this amount of money, right? That doesn't actually happen. But from the pharmaceutical industry all the way to physicians, right, we actually, and especially health insurers, which are not healthcare, they're insurance companies, they show up, they pretty much live in the halls of Congress mandating that prices continue to go up and up and up, right? Like, we see this all the time. This is not, whether it be for prescription drugs that have been around a billion years that are bought and rescheduled under a different trade name and brought out of a patent black hole, and the prices go through the roof, right? Like, that's not, that has absolutely nothing to do with productivity. It has nothing to do with efficiencies. It has nothing to do with need. It has to do with lobbyists who are telling Congress what the costs for a given product are going to be.
Sure.
And education and healthcare are the two things where you see that, right? Like, it's, again, like the lobbying that takes place from higher education to ensure that our federally backed loan system basically remains the most unstable, nonsense system of borrowing that exists in the country. The only other place that we saw something even more absurd was in the housing market, but because that drove up that form of federally backed loan system drove up real costs that impacted like a real-time economy. And back in 2006, we saw a massive drive through the ceiling for housing prices, and that was completely unstable, and loans going out to people that really couldn't sustain those loans in the first place. The whole system collapsed around it. Like, we don't see that with healthcare and education just yet, because it takes so long for the loans to actually be called back in, right? Like, somebody who's paying hundreds of thousands of dollars on a law degree today isn't actually going to have to pay all those back tomorrow, and their note is not a sellable, mortgageable product, right? So there's no one looking to reel it in as quickly as possible. I think that their methodology is flawed in the sense that, again, they're playing that trick, and I don't want to point fingers at conservatives, but I do find conservatives do it more than anybody until at least the last 10 years or so, conflating ideas like healthcare and health insurance, which have nothing to do with one another, or conflating ideas like higher education and the student loan system, which have nothing to do with one another. A tenured professor at WPI, right, can be share a genius level of knowledge on a park bench, right? It has nothing to do with a grant system or a loan system. That's where the costs to actually sit in front of that professor come from, right? That system in the middle that connects the consumer with the product they desire. Healthcare, a doctor can provide, a paramedic can provide magic out in the field, right? Literal magic in the field. It's the insurance company that assigns a cost to that system that then forces the consumer to play ball along their terms. But they're not related systems at all, other than the fact that they're intertwined in a way that makes the consumer feel they are one and the same.
Well, I'm not intelligent enough to either 100% understand this book or certainly defend this book. I'm very heartened by this idea, and I wish to believe in this idea because, like I said, they do go through and at least say that they're looking at things like that, and that saying at the end of the day, if you know, most of healthcare ends up being things like doctor salaries, and if you look at the graph of doctor salaries and you look at the price of healthcare, they basically go up at the same rate.
Yeah.
And like, these other things cost money, but that's not the reason that this thing triples over 50 years. That said, I appreciate this argument because I feel like we look at these things and we're like, there seems to be nothing that we can do. We cannot freaking make healthcare cheaper. The rent is too damn high. We cannot figure out how to make housing cheaper. Like, in our socialist utopia, maybe we could do it. But in the mixed economy that we have, there seems to be very little that we can do, despite everybody really wanting this to happen, to affect these prices. And what these guys are saying is like, yeah, that's right. Because it's just like the law of gravity, baby. It's like manufacturing gets better, and so healthcare gets more expensive. And as long as the economy is growing, that's okay. And you may need to take some of that extra manufacturing cash and use it to give poor people healthcare so that they don't get screwed. But if the economy is growing as a whole, then that's good. And that's just kind of how it's going to go. Now, they, in their final chapter, and this is a very short book, so I read this book like twice this morning. Their basic recommendation for getting costs to fall in an industry are either making a breakthrough in productivity. For example, if you used AIs to start automating a lot of medical analyses,
sure,
as people are trying to do, or to increase the number of skilled workers by getting more people access to college degrees, getting them through that process. They're kind of like, that's how you do it. You increase the number of skilled workers, the cost of these things is going to, if not go down, level off. If you increase the amount of productivity breakthroughs in an area, the cost is going to, if not go down, level off. And they're like, and obviously, like, those are good, those are like good things. So they're basically like, if you do good things, you can probably ameliorate this in some industries. But again, it's like, if you suddenly have a breakthrough in college where everybody wants to go to internet college,
mm-hmm.
so now you have a few superstar professors who are making most of the professor money, and, you know, the people who run the websites, and that there's a ton of professors, there's way fewer jobs of a teaching professor now.
Right.
A ton of people who are teaching professors are going to be like, great, well, we're going to go into actually, I don't know. I guess it depends on how that goes. You're sort of decreasing the number of jobs. Again, it gets complicated. Like, you're decreasing.
I don't think it's complicated at all. I think they're obscuring, like, again, some very simple realities that, like, putting healthcare into a bucket where, like, the cost of doctors, right, like,
yeah.
goes up. Well, not all doctors. Right, just the specialties that insurance companies have over years decided they're going to favor and drive the costs up on. Like, so if you were to go to medical school today, like, what are your big choices going to be if you're going to look to be a high earning physician? Like urology, you know, specialized forms of surgery like transplant. But it's also the reason why, if you even a place like in Worcester, UMass, like, up until recently, they might still be doing it. They were offering free tuition if you promised them 5 years in their family practice service, because
right.
nobody wants to be a family practice physician because there isn't as much money in it. So, you know, people are being drawn to specialties. But mm-hmm. why did the value of those specialties go up? Because insurers set up the coding, right? Like, it's not like the doctors aren't sitting around in a yearly meeting saying, okay, this is what. Whatever. This is what bladder surgery costs in the urology department. Insurance companies are the ones that are deciding where those costs come from, and then inadvertently they're impacting the more desirable subfields within the larger field of healthcare, and more professionals are being driven to those specialties that end up costing the consumer.
I love this topic because I feel like the longer I talk about it, the more I keep arguing. I find I'm arguing against myself,
yeah,
and then I'm arguing for myself, and then I turn around and argue against myself. This is why I love this. Anyway,
I'll let it go.
This is a great paper.
Yeah.
This is a cool thing to think about. I really hope that this is why costs are going up, because, again, if this is why costs are going up, then what they're saying is this costs are going up in certain areas because that's how an economy works.
Yeah.
And if that's how an economy works, then the solution is not worry about the financial backing of financial situation around healthcare or education, because you're only going to get yourself maybe a 10% decrease with that. If you want to get education down to being a tenth the price that it is now,
mm-hmm.
other things it's going to take other things. It's not going to take just figuring out the different student loan setup or making students have worse gyms.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that argument. I wish that were true. That whenever you're like, this is actually just a physically impossible, numerically impossible problem to solve.
Yeah.
That's how it goes. I kind of like that idea of just saying this is actually impossible.
It absolves us of actually having to deal with anything, so I can see why some people like it.
It cuts down the number of things that you feel like you should be trying, and then you bang your head against the wall
right.
for 20 years in your town, and then you get some kind of change to happen, and then it doesn't solve the problem, and then you're like, damn it, what the hell happened? The idea of just being like, don't think that there's like a lot of low hanging fruit there is maybe another way to put it.
I think I'll just throw one more thing out there think that one of the intersections with healthcare and education are interesting as well, too. And I have a very limited experience in healthcare in the back, but I do remember a couple times with folks that I worked with that you would see physicians, like, basically the day that they finished paying off their student loans, right?
Yeah.
And then they just went
yeah.
from people eating peanut butter sandwiches to a dude wearing a Breitling and driving a Bentley. But unfortunately, I also think that's one of the areas that you can map out a high return on that investment of education. And I think that's kind of a flaw in some of what they're discussing as well, too, that the return on investment for education, it seems, has never been lower. I mean, I don't understand how anyone could argue that, right? I mean, if we agree mostly as a nation, right, that wages have been mostly stagnant in the United States for decades now, but costs of education have been going up astronomically. That doesn't seem to balance itself out, right? I mean, what does it cost to be a teacher in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, you know, to get a master's degree in education from a publicly funded school, right? Like, way more than it did in the 60s and 70s. And the ability to pay down those loans to participate, it doesn't even seem like a reasonable system. So if their argument seems to be, well, just ignore the costs that are involved and keep working your ass off to pay off these loans.
What you're saying is, are people, is the education that you get, can you turn that into money? That is where there has been a decrease. That you, like, the amount of the education that you get is probably similar to the education you would get 30 years ago in terms of whatever.
Yeah.
But your ability to turn that amount of education into money has gone down.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a, but the cost of the education hasn't gone down. That's just because that's how much it costs to get that amount of education, to create that amount of education, would be the argument that people don't, the reason people are buying it in part is at that price still is because of, or that so many people are buying it in part is because of loans, and in part it's because of cultural inertia that we think that this is how the world works, that you get a college degree and you're set, which we've talked about many times on the show, that this is probably definitely not true and heading to be more not true.
Mm-hmm.
But in that case, the argument would be that fewer people should get a college degree or go into college, but also that the price of college wouldn't necessarily go down. That it would still, because it's still going to cost that much to do. It's still going to cost as much to train a bunch of people to play a string quartet and have them play the string quartet as it did yesterday. No matter whether people want to pay more money for that or not,
mm-hmm.
it still is going to take the same amount of effort to make that happen. So it may be a thing where it's like the string quartets, like, we cut the cost to the, we basically can't even afford to be a quartet. Maybe a lot of colleges end up closing because they're like, there's actually not a cheaper way to do mm-hmm. the college that we do. Like, the online thing is a separate deal, but as far as the, like, I go to a place and hang out in the quad college, there's probably not a much cheaper way to do it. So if fewer people want to do it, it doesn't get cheaper, and so more people want to do it. It just stays the same price, and fewer people do it. That's kind of how the supply and demand curve might go.
There are a handful.
I don't understand this in summary.
In our economy that we have no control over, so we should just learn to live with them, and they're going to stink forever.
God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Also, the wisdom to embrace libertarian principles in thought and in deed.
What else you got, Mike?
This is the 508 Show. What I have is nothing else for this week's show. Is there something you want to talk about?
Oh, I don't think so. No, that was exhausting.
Oh, boy. Next week, we're going to have a different show where we're not going to talk about economics we don't understand.
Are you sure?
Well,
it was kind of enjoyable.
We understand it enough to be dangerous. We're going to talk about economics we either completely understand or economics we don't understand. We slightly understand them on next week's 508.
Looking forward
to it. Tune in for that, everybody. Thanks, Gabby, for producing the show. We'll talk to you, everybody, next week.